But then Shug's aunt, panicked and angry, called him from South Carolina. A homicide squad had kicked in her door at dawn in a raid, looking for him. Armed men had told her that her nephew was a highly dangerous gang member wanted for a brutal execution in the Bronx. They turned her place upside down and forced Shug's cousins against the wall at gunpoint. Shug's aunt told him that the police had information that he was armed and willing to shoot police rather than be captured. Shug knew that the only person who would have known where he had been was B-Love, who was now telling O'Malley everything. Shug's aunt warned him never to come back to South Carolina. Once more, Shug hit the road. 4. Make it rain. At midnight, deep in the prison dormitory sometime in mid-December, Pipe wrote to Pete in blood code sitting in a pool of light thrown by a lamp clipped to his cot. The shock waves of the Thanksgiving murders were still reverberating through Soundview. The betrayal by sex money murder of their Castle Hill brethren had reignited long-dormant prejudices between the neighboring projects. The Castle Hill gangsters said there would be a bloodbath in reprisal against Soundview. Pete and Twin's partnership under the aegis of sex money murder had once united the projects, but now they were at war. A letter appeared in Soundview from Pete that had Twin R.I.P. scrawled upside down, a disrespect to show he was pleased at his former partner's murder. Some said that there would be retaliation against Pete's mother, news that reached Pipe in prison. Pipe warned Pete in a letter. In death row is that 550-101 Blazing Billy had thick like quicks flip the clip, so Bear only got one Skyline 102 that the word is Dust Eater number 2 is going after number 1. Translation: the word in New York is that the first superior of sex money murder has put out a hit on the remaining twin because he is going after your family. Pipe added that he hadn't read Machiavelli's The Prince and Sun Tzu's Art of War for nothing. He ended his letter with a declaration of loyalty. I don't give a fuck what we go through, I'll always love you. He signed the letter, VP, a.k.a. the Gorgeous Gangsta. Pipe had the phrase tattooed across his midriff by a convict who had made a tattoo gun with the motor from a Walkman. He signed off, Thug Life, always and forever. Pipe had begun to sense a sadness and longing in Pete's letters. The sex money murder leader was alone and missed Pipe and his loyal lieutenants. He had always had Bear or Big Ant or one of them around to follow his orders and act as an extension of his ego. Pete received Pipe's letter with glee. On December 28, 1997, he wrote a reply. It was never sent. Forselli told the North Carolina investigators that Peter Rolock was ordering hits by letter. Bevins and Tadeo applied for intercepts to read all Rolock's incoming and outgoing mail. On December 29th, carrying a warrant, they entered the Charlotte Mecklenburg cells to search Rolock's possessions. They were accompanied by a lone deputy in case Rolock turned violent. Bevins made sure not to turn his back on sex money murder's 23-year-old leader. But Rolock, wearing round-rimmed glasses, rose to his feet politely when they arrived. They asked him to step out of his cell where they handcuffed him. Tadeo informed him that any materials concerning his case would be returned, but that the rest would be taken. Rolock nodded obligingly. The officers entered a meticulously neat cell. Under the bed were several transparent plastic bins containing 51 letters, most received, some unsent. There were address books and documents, one a fact sheet about STDs, and 53 photographs. One handwritten document was a list of black civil rights leaders, including Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. The officers gleaned that Rolock saw himself not as a murderous drug dealer, but as a leader, rising up to claim what was his at the head of a small army bent on economic emancipation. Bevins pulled out letters from Rolock's father in prison. He told his son to be a strong black male and not to talk to the police. He extolled the power of black culture and told him to look after black women. In an unsent letter Rolock had written to his half-brother, he urged him not to get involved in the drug game. He also hinted at his high-level entertainment connections. "I don't know if Daddy told you before I got locked up, me at Tyson Beckford, the model, was going half and half on a record label. I also had Puff Daddy and Biggie Smalls do a few shows for me." He added, "When I come home, I will start all over to build a family business. I want to put something together for all our family that is so tight none of our loved ones will have to struggle. Again, you are of age now and can be a big part of this, but you must stay out of jail. Don't make the same mistakes me and Daddy made. Stay in school and get a profession. Knowledge is power. I want you to always remember this no matter how long our father has been away from us. We are blessed. If we stay close to him, we will be ahead in life. Remember that." Another, to his girlfriend, scolded her for abandoning him in his hour of need. And finally, there were pages of Rolock's self-mythologizing rap songs that extolled a ghetto celebrity, young, rich, and deadly, who wore enough ice to make the average motherfucker shiver. Rolock railed against snitches. "Spending G's on a bitch instead of trying to get rich, flip a few bricks, nigger snitch, sign a plea like a bitch, that's why I keep my circle tight." He went on to rhapsodize about cars, Mercedes-Benz and NSX, and his sexual prowess. "Dick, harder than a broom, ready to rip a bitch's womb." Bevins and Tadeo were looking for the proof of the sex money murder enterprise. They found it in the songs. "Making moves, nigga, you hesitate and you lose. Bust my gun, paid my dues, paved the way for my crew. I made moves, nigga, you hesitate and you're history. I'm a sex-money-murder motherfucker till the death of me." In the letters, Rolock detailed orders for Green Eyes to carry out one of the murders on Thanksgiving, among other key facts. And there was a letter to a gangster called Pipe. Finally, they started to work through the photographs. Midway through, they found a picture of Rolock flanked by two celebrities. On one side stood Tyson Beckford. On the other, dressed in a red top and blue jeans with a slender bare midriff, was the model Tyra Banks. In January 1998, O'Malley found the man at the top of one of Forselli's charts, John Castro, incarcerated at Otisville in upstate New York. O'Malley had put out a warrant for his arrest, but Castro ended up getting picked up in Florida in possession of a large amount of drugs under the pseudonym Orrin Johnson. O'Malley drove to the prison and gave Castro his spiel. After Castro consulted with his lawyer, he flipped too, confessing to murders in which he had had a hand. At Jimmy's Bar in the Bronx, he had shot a man who helped himself to beers behind the bar. On another occasion, he hired a hitman to take out a man selling drugs on a Washington Heights block. Castro drove the hitman to the scene, but when he hopped out of the car to deliver summary justice, he pressed the magazine release on the gun, and the magazine went clattering to the sidewalk. Castro leapt in front of him and ended up killing the drug dealer himself. Castro offered a detailed insight into the sex-money-murder hierarchy and the murder of Barnes, for which he had offered any potential killers a bounty. By February, O'Malley and Bob Ryan, the dogged financial investigator, also born in the Bronx, were beginning to map out sex-money-murder's finances. On Ryan's wall in his office was an IRS recruitment poster of Al Capone that declared, "Only an accountant could catch Al Capone." Ryan knew from Codd that the gang had a bank account and that they had even incorporated. Codd produced a pay stub from which Ryan was able to track down the account. Through that, and with Codd's help, Ryan was able to identify the Castle Hill man and sex money murder associate Nelson Rios. He had been arrested by Secret Service agents who had found a handgun and counterfeiting material on various computers at his house. Rios was out on bail when Ryan and O'Malley arrested him again and took him to the 45th Precinct. O'Malley rolled up his sleeves and flipped his chair around in the interview room to face him, while Ryan laid out some of Rios's forged documents on the table. "We know what you did," said O'Malley. "And this man here is an IRS investigator. This is a federal racketeering case. You're in big trouble." Ryan had never seen anyone flip so quickly. Information poured out. He admitted that money in SMM accounts was laundered drug money, as he tapped his feet and fidgeted. When they left the interview room for a break, O'Malley joked, "We could put a pair of drumsticks in his hands and he'd be beating out a tune for us." Rios explained how the gang had incorporated as SMMC Inc. and about the corporate paychecks. Rios had been clever enough to pay in amounts of less than $10,000, known as structuring. Anything above that, and the bank would ask for his social security number and job, and the money would automatically trigger a currency transaction report, CTR, to the IRS, inviting scrutiny. Structuring payments to avoid CTRs in this way was a federal crime under the Money Laundering Control Act of 1986. It was a textbook method for cleaning drug money, but Rios' efficiency had merely provided a paper trail for Ryan. In May 1998, Ryan flew to Pittsburgh, where he learned how the gang had laundered money by overpaying on car leases, part of the scam with Three Rivers Leasing. The dealership had avoided filing IRS 8300 forms reporting cash payments over $10,000 and had also made sure none of the gang members' names appeared on lease paperwork in case they were stopped by police. Ryan's investigation would deepen, ensnaring more in the Bronx underworld who worked with SMM. Ryan arrested Harry Miranda, a Bronx playboy involved in real estate who secured stash houses for Codd and some of the others in the crew. Shelton Cooley Smith ran a clothing and fashion design business in Maryland. He was arrested for buying cocaine and heroin from SMM and opening pipelines in Maryland, and also for his involvement with SMM bank accounts. Ryan confiscated his clothing business, a Lincoln Navigator, and a Honda CRX, among other assets. As Ryan plunged into SMM and its network of affiliates, he seized about $2 million in assets. As more sex money murder members cooperated, Ryan was brought in on the proffer sessions. Introduced as a special agent, he gave his own short spiel and said that lawyers' fees were not covered by attorney-client privilege, and any funds derived from narcotics proceeds or any other illegal activity, as defined by the Money Laundering Act of 1986, could be subject to forfeiture. The lawyers in the room looked at their shoes. Shug stole back into New York City sometime in January 1998, visited a woman he knew in Queens, then went to a tattoo parlor there to get SMM inked on his right pectoral muscle in rounded copperplate. That same month he learned that Rolock had been convicted at a trial of drug trafficking and that Codd, TV Dave, and many others had testified against him. Codd had tried to back out at the last minute, but Detective Lugo and others convinced him to take the stand. Pete would be sentenced in a few months. Finally, Pete's run seemed to be over. In the Bronx, Shug linked up with Bimo, who told him that everything had changed, that the feds and the police were everywhere. Bimo said he had a solution. They could find a new future in Cleveland, where Shug had been once before. Bimo said that the city had a black mayor and that it was a good place to sell drugs and get rich without too much police harassment. They decided to make a run. Shug smoked weed the whole way to settle his nerves, but the pair sniped constantly. Both were anxious. They set up a base in an apartment on 116th Street in downtown Cleveland through a connection of Bimo's. In between crack sales, they watched movies and picked up women at an after-hours club. On April 10th, 1998, they learned that Pete had been sentenced to 40 years for drug trafficking in North Carolina. He would be lucky to get out of prison in his 60s. Shug broke down in tears. Murdering Twin hadn't freed Pete. It had made no difference. "He did it to himself, man," said Bimo. Pete had gotten greedy. Worse, in Bimo's eyes, the only thing Pete gave him after he killed Chiron was a gun. "Go and rob someone," Pete had told him. "Fuck the pistol," Bimo said. "He ain't never given me nothing." With $6,000 in his pocket, Shug decided to return to Springfield. He moved around for a few days, and then hooked up with a cousin of his old flame, Gina. She took him to an apartment opposite a liquor store in the southeastern part of town. One day, Shug tried to call Latoya in her apartment on Rosedale Avenue from the landline in the apartment. There was no answer. He had no way of knowing that ATF agents were standing in her apartment interviewing her, and were now writing down the Springfield number that came up on caller ID. The agents called Rob Berger at the Southern District, who traced it. The next day, at around 1:45 p.m., Shug heard dogs barking downstairs. Gina's cousin told him to lie down and ignore it. Shug, worn out from hours of lovemaking, lay back and closed his eyes. Then he heard a knock on the door. Gina's cousin went to answer it. A small team of law enforcement officers, including two U.S. Marshals and ATF agents Jim Markowski and Tom Lister, had taken positions around the building with rifles drawn. An agent knocked at the door. A young woman, he assumed to be around 18, opened the door a crack. Lister stuck his foot in the door and demanded to know who was upstairs. When she said that her boyfriend and a friend of his from the Bronx were in the house, Lister charged through the door past her while officers behind him led her away. At the top of the stairs, they found a man wandering around. He was pulled out and handcuffed. Two agents entered the apartment. Another agent covered the door. The two men expertly cleared the room before moving to the bedroom. Shug heard a boom as a door crashed open somewhere in the house. "Get the fuck down," he heard from a room next door. Instinctively, he remembered the guns in the bedside drawer and for a split second considered shooting his way out. He made his way over to the window, saw the 20-foot drop, and thought about it before he caught sight of armed police outside. His will to fight evaporated. He gave up and sat with his head against the bed's headboard, arms folded. Agents burst into the room to find a 20-ish African-American male dressed in a brand-new blue Adidas sweatsuit. "Sup?" said Shug with mock puzzlement. "What's this all about?" The men tore him out of bed and threw him against the wall, fastening handcuffs that bit into his wrists. Outside, they demanded his ID. Shug asked them to loosen the cuffs before tugging out his wallet. It contained the fake license that had worked in South Carolina. Handing it over, he said he was up from South Carolina visiting friends. The men looked him up and down. Shug thought he was in with a chance because he hadn't been put in a car yet. Then one of the marshals put the warrant picture next to Shug's face. "Nah, that's him," he said. "Your run is over." They pulled up his shirt and caught sight of the SMM tattoo on his chest. "Sex, money, murder, huh?" said the marshal. In jail, Shug slept more soundly than he had in years. For cops, it's a truism that the guilty sleep after arrest. In some sense, Shug was relieved to be off the street where he wasn't going to be shot or arrested anymore. The following day, he refused to tell a judge his real name, thinking he could still slip out of the noose. He was remanded without bail. A day later, he was transported to a federal prison in New Hampshire. The austere and highly regimented atmosphere was nothing like the state prisons he had been in before. He asked one of the marshals what was going on. "I'm not going to lie to you," he said. "You're not going to see the streets any time soon. A lot of y'all are facing the death penalty." Shug screwed up his face in disbelief. The following day he was driven to an airstrip, where an unmarked plane sat on the tarmac surrounded by vans with flashing blue lights. Shackled in a three-piece suit, leg restraints and a belly chain that his hands were fastened to, Shug was escorted up the steps and into the bowels of the plane. This wasn't the sort of treatment they gave prisoners in the New York State system. Inside, as he was marched to the back, he saw a familiar face. There, in an orange jumpsuit, sat Pete, although much thinner than Shug remembered him.
"Yo, what up, Mo?" Pete laughed.
Shug felt that there was little to celebrate. "I'll talk to you when we get off the plane, man," he said irritably as he shuffled past. Rows of inmates were shackled to the floor. In the back, Shug was manacled to a chair armrest and the floor. One of the other convicts muttered something about only the marshals having parachutes if the plane went down. Shug leaned back and went to sleep. He awoke in New York, where they disembarked, and he was placed in a van with Pete.
"Yo, what the fuck is up?"
asked Shug.
"You know B-Love's telling, right?"
Pete was calm.
Ah, man, we're going to find everything out. Don't worry about it. He smiled. You happy to see me, man? Pete tried to introduce Shug to some other bloods in the van. I'm not with that shit right now, Shug stormed. I'm facing some real bullshit here. The bloods were riled at the disrespect, but Pete placated them. The van moved along the Brooklyn waterfront and past empty warehouses and cracked asphalt lots. Then the Metropolitan Detention Center loomed into view. Once inside, Shug surrendered himself to paranoia. His progression from kid in the projects to 24-year-old gangster, enemy of the state, was now complete. The processing lasted until the early hours of the morning, prolonged by Shug's furious outbursts and refusal to follow orders. He refused to be fingerprinted. They asked Shug for his federal ID number. Shug said he couldn't remember it. Pete stepped in smoothly and calmed him. Come on, Mo, please. Shug settled down when he discovered that he and Pete were to be housed in the same block. A few hours later, they had their first court appearance. It was May 7, 1998. Shug went next door to Pete's cell. He was holding everyone up as he primped and fussed, brushing his hair with short, vigorous strokes to make it shine. 100 strokes make 'em poke, Pete said with a wink. While Pete preened, Mac 11 approached Shug on the landing outside Pete's cell. Shug hadn't seen him since Thanksgiving Day. Shug called Pete out of his cell to introduce them. Pete wore a pair of Kazal glasses, just one of the 5 pairs he had with him, and which he would wear in court to give him a bookish air. Pete greeted them like an emperor giving an audience. "Yo, Pete, this is the one that put that work in," said Shug. Pete embraced Mac 11. "Don't worry about all this," Pete told him. "Together we stand, divided we fall." Shug saw Mac 11 beam, radiant to have met his idol. They were strip-searched and placed in a van going to the Mother Court, the Southern District of New York's Daniel P. Moynihan Courthouse on Foley Square. The van drove to the south side of the building on Pearl Street between the courthouse and the Metropolitan Correctional Center. Steel shutters opened electronically, and the van proceeded to an elevator that dropped 3 stories into the basement. When the doors opened again, the van moved forward into a concrete subterranean enclosure, and then onto a large black steel plate. The van revolved 180 degrees on the steel plate before it backed up to a small door. Everything the prisoners did or said was recorded by multiple cameras connected to a bank of 20 or so monitors deep in a darkened room on the 4th floor. All conversations were noted by the marshals. Shug and Pete bunny-hopped in their chains to general holding cells. There, handcuffed but without leg restraints, they got on another elevator which took them to the 14th floor. They stepped out, facing 2 cages in a small confined area of bleached white stone and reinforced concrete with a speckled floor, known as the bullpen. Herded into one of the cages, Shug took a seat on a gray plastic bench against a wall. A low steel partition offered some modesty for prisoners who wanted to avail themselves of the brushed steel toilet against another wall. Housed in the other cage were Roe, Total Package, and several other members of Sex Money Murder, along with Pete's uncle George Wallace. All had been swept up by the feds. After a while, the marshals unlocked the prisoners and swung open the 6-inch-thick oak door that led into the wood-paneled courtroom. As the prisoners shuffled in, defense attorneys gathered to watch. Pete led his crew in a flamboyant pimp role. Their footfalls were deadened by the deep royal blue carpet. Pete's father had walked into these courtrooms to be convicted under the RICO statutes. Now, a generation later, his son was facing justice in the same courts. There were so many gangsters that they were led to the jury box rather than the defense tables. The courtroom was full of people from Soundview, women in low-cut tops with freshly painted nails who greeted the men as if they were rock stars. The prisoners were so unruly that each had 2 marshals assigned to supervise him. "No talking in the courtroom," they ordered. Shug looked at a marshal with contempt. "Get the fuck out of here. The judge ain't even here yet." Gone were the impeccable manners of the mafia dons the marshals had once escorted. Shug and the crew carried on talking while their lawyers came over. Shug was approached by a Saturnine man who introduced himself as Martin Siegel. Shug disliked his quiet manner, his detachment. The court rose as Judge Miriam Goldman Cederbaum, a diminutive woman with an empathetic expression who had a reputation as a relatively liberal judge, took her seat. She asked the marshals to remove the defendant's handcuffs. Slowly and methodically, she asked each defendant to stand. With conversational warmth, she asked each of them a bit about themselves, jobs they had worked and their level of education. Rolock spoke first, but mugged at some young women in the back while he did so. When Shug's turn came, he claimed he had dropped out of school in 11th grade, even though it was the 9th grade, adding that he had achieved a GED while incarcerated in Massachusetts. The procedure wound on. Shug barely paid attention until the reality of his fate was confirmed. "As the court is aware from the previous superseder," said the prosecutor, Alexandra Shapiro, "there are some defendants who are death-eligible, and several of the new defendants are death-eligible as well." Cederbaum asked, "Yes, who are those?" As the prosecutor read off Pete's and Shug's names, there was an audible gasp from the Soundview contingent. A chill spread over Shug's skin. He looked at Pete, who stared serenely ahead. Pete's charges numbered 28 counts: racketeering, murder, kidnapping, tampering with a witness, and the use of a machine gun in furtherance of some of these crimes. Shug faced 8 counts, including murder, racketeering, and kidnapping. He couldn't understand why they were thinking about executing him. He'd seen people get murdered his whole life and nothing much had happened to the killers. Even Fat Mike's killer got life in the state prison, not the death penalty, and that was for 3 bodies. "Twin got 2 bodies," Shug raged at his lawyer. "He a killer. They gonna murder me for rocking him?" With the main sex money murder players in custody, O'Malley and the team widened the net. Tyson Beckford's name kept coming out in proffers as a close associate of Pete's. The detectives couldn't understand how somebody so successful could be caught up in this. They brought him in. Tyson arrived with a lawyer, Eddie Hayes, dressed in a pinstriped Savile Row suit. Hayes had celebrity connections with everyone from Robert De Niro to Anna Wintour. The lawyer had come in alone a few days before and asked what charges his client faced. O'Malley said that there were no charges, they just wanted to talk. Beckford knew they had nothing on him. O'Malley showed him to one of the proffer rooms, where Forselli, the prosecutor, and Benny Tirado awaited him. Tirado tried to pat down Tyson, who told him in no uncertain terms to keep his hands to himself. Beckford had a tattoo on his neck that seemed to reference sex money murder. O'Malley threw out a few questions. Beckford said that he and Pete shared an interest in motorcycles. When O'Malley mentioned the murder, racketeering, and drug charges against Rolock, Beckford gave a speech about Pete's virtue and his contributions to his community. O'Malley had no aces to play. Beckford asked with a wry grin at O'Malley, "Anything else?" The investigators shook their heads. O'Malley walked him to the elevator but couldn't hold his tongue. "Listen, that was a nice little dog and pony show in there," he said. "Hopefully me and you will see each other again. Maybe next time you'll be here with handcuffs on." Beckford smiled and looked his questioner directly in the face. "You got the wrong guy, man," he said. "All I do all day is fuck Tyra Banks and lift weights." The elevator door opened, and Beckford and his lawyer vanished. One evening, a few weeks later, Forselli and Tirado strolled into the Sports Plus Café on Castle Hill Avenue like two sheriffs entering a Wild West saloon. They pulled up stools on one side of the bar. On the other were scowling sex money murder members. O'Malley thought Forselli took a risk sitting at a bar with gangsters who favored sneaking up on their victims and shooting them in the back of the head. But Forselli wanted to send the message that he was unafraid, that there would be no sanctuary for gangsters. He scorned Rolock as a coward for shooting unarmed men. Forselli's rolled-up sleeves revealed thick, muscled forearms adorned with ink. Over several years he had added dragons, snakes, a tiger,
and St. Michael, the patron saint of police. Ignoring the sneers across the bar, the detectives laughed about the previous week's arrest at the Bronx courthouse. They had targeted Pete's cousin, Chio White, who was still out on the street, thumbing his nose at the cops. If Forselli arrested him, it would send a clear message to the neighborhood that the police were coming for all of them. They snatched him on the other side of a metal detector after he'd taken his belt off to go through. Chio thrust his hands in the air when the cops pounced, only to have his pants drop to his ankles, revealing that he wore no underwear, eliciting ribald laughter from everyone around. O'Malley and Forselli had created an extensive list of SMM members, and as information continued to flood out of proffers, they were able to cross-reference crimes and hierarchical positions in the group. More arrests followed. They'd made it a priority to go after the most violent offenders or anyone Rollout could use to kill cooperating witnesses. Pipe's brother Roe was one of the most dangerous and ardent of his followers. When they learned he was being held on a parole violation at the Bronx House of Detention, Forselli turned up and arrested him on a federal warrant. Roe assumed he was being taken to a precinct to be interviewed, but once they crossed over into Manhattan and started to speed south down the FDR Drive, he panicked. "Where are you taking me, man?" he demanded. Forselli told him the case was going federal. At first, Roe didn't believe him, but as they neared the Metropolitan Correctional Center and the court complex, he slumped. He knew what federal time meant. As the detectives talked in the bar, they struggled to hear each other against the rising volume of the bar's sound system. The song "One Life to Live," from the album "Make It Rain" by Soundview rappers Lord Tariq and Peter Guns, echoed around the bar. The rappers had finally made it big, despite not being signed by Puff Daddy. Their album was an undisguised homage to Pistol Pete, Sex Money Murder, and Soundview. When Pete was arrested, Lord Tariq had made a very public gesture of unclasping his $25,000 Rolex and handing it to Pete's mom as a gift. Now the song's words pounded into the detective's ears. "You got one life to live, one gun to bust." The chorus built to the kicker. "It's all about sex, money, life or death." 5. Bangin' for Their Rats. Back in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, Pete and Shug took over the dormitory in 4 South. The prison held a maximum of 1,861 inmates. One new inmate called it Snitch Central, the last stop before cutting a deal with the feds or trying to beat the government at trial. Shug got a job buffing the recreation deck's floor and put in a word for Pete, who began cleaning the warden's office. But within weeks, Pete was having sex with one staff member and arranging for another to smuggle his letters out. On darker days, Pete seethed about Cod and B-Love's cooperation. "We need to whack their moms, yo," he said. "Send a message." On days like that, he talked about a master plan. "We're going out with a bang," he declared. "We're going to run the prisons like we did the streets. We're going out like ghetto celebrities." Shug wondered whether Pete had planned all along to get everyone in prison with him so he wouldn't have to face the time alone. After supper one night, Shug and Pete's conversation turned to Twin. Pete froze when Shug asked about Twin's role as a snitch. Shug said he had thought that by killing Twin, they would allow Pete to walk free. But then here they all were. It had made no difference. Pete paused, crossed his legs leisurely, and then pushed his glasses up his nose. "Yeah, that was a bad call." What the fuck? Shug thought. A bad call? He'd thrown his life away for a bad call? Pete seemed to be intimating that Twin wasn't a snitch. Wordlessly, Shug pulled on his headphones, stuck his hands in his sweatpants, and shuffled back to his bunk. Never did they discuss it again. For days, he brooded over how he'd been played, used to kill a man who wasn't a rat. He felt completely trapped. The code was that he be loyal to Sex Money Murder, but the code had failed him, had deceived him. Pete had played him like a pawn. Shug increasingly gave himself over to gratification from violence.
One evening, a Jamaican gangster called Ross was using the phone longer than allowed. "You on my time," Shug complained, but Ross ignored him. Shug persisted. "You done, son?" The Jamaican turned to Shug. "Go suck your mother." Shug swallowed it and forced himself to think tactically, as Pete had taught him. "Okay, man," he said, and raised his hands in a placatory gesture. "No problem." Shug stalked back to the dormitory, formulating a plan. If he'd had a knife or a shiv, he would have buried it deep in Ross's guts. Back at his bunk, he spotted his neighbor's combination padlock. He could put it in a sock and use it as a cosh. Shug tested the weight of the lock in the sock. He tried various lengths to see how it might best swing. He shortened it up so that he could swing fast, but with enough slack that the momentum would carry through. Shug stuffed the weapon in the pocket of his sweatpants. Ross strutted past.
"That pussy rasclat push me for de phone," he laughed to his bunkmate, climbing into his top bunk.
When the lights went out, Shug crept out of his bunk and moved up beside the Jamaicans. He whirled the lock down on the man's forehead with a crack. Metal on bone. A perfect one shot, thought Shug. Straight up sniper shit. The Jamaican jumped to his feet, screaming, "Murder! Murder!" Shug swung at his legs, trying to hit him again. Guards ran in. Shug tossed the bloody sock on Ross's bunk before guards knocked him to the floor. Handcuffed, he was made to sit cross-legged as paramedics tried to revive the Jamaican, who was drifting in and out of consciousness. The sheets on his bed were soaked with blood. The assistant warden entered the fray and asked Ross, who came to groggily, who had hit him. He pointed at Shug. Standing at the back of the dorm, Pete gave Shug a smile. "Good work," he said. Shug found himself in the hole. Pete sent him batteries for his Walkman, and again passed on his compliments through a prison officer. "I was told to tell you that Pete said that was a good shot," the officer said. Shug was charged with assault, which carried another 5 years, but he no longer cared. He was considered so disruptive, particularly when he was emboldened by consorting with his SMM brothers, that he was moved to the county jail in Passaic, New Jersey. He found the regime there slightly more relaxed, so he took advantage and blooded in a couple of inmates. Sometime during his stay, he received a letter from prosecutors saying they would not file a death notice against him and the other defendants in the case. Shug's charges were death-eligible, but prosecutors had to check with Main Justice in D.C. before they could file a death notice, normally done just before trial. Prosecutors did, however, receive permission from Main Justice to file the death notice against Pete. Shug was soon in trouble again. He talked back to a guard, and a fight broke out. New bloods jumped in to back him up. Shug was taken to a hospital off-site where he received 12 stitches in his upper lip. The next day in court, Pete and Roe teased him about his giant lip in the holding cell. They said he looked like a duck. Shug pouted and began shouting so loudly that Forselli could hear him even in the public gallery on the other side of the heavy oak door. Forselli was there to monitor proceedings and to protect the judge, court officials, or anyone in the public gallery if things got out of hand. His street informants had said there were death threats against Judge Cederbaum and the prosecutors. Some were even ordering up Santeria hexes on the detectives. In court, Shug defied the marshals and growled at anyone who spoke to him. He stomped the floor, demanding medical attention. At the end of the proceedings, when the marshals approached, he shouted, "Y'all can go get the motherfucking goon squad. I ain't going nowhere. Look what they done to my lip, man. I ain't going back to Jersey. Motherfucking police tried to kill me in there." He said he wanted to be in MCC with his co-defendants. Out of habit, O'Malley sat at the back of the courtroom near the door. It offered a prime vantage point for everything unfolding in court, who attended in the public gallery and who the defendants waved at, which often offered leads. He could also read the faces of the jury. O'Malley took a personal dislike to Shug with his temper tantrums and his fervent allegiance to Pete and SMM. Marshals were coming in from other courts to deal with him. Shug's lawyer made a request to Judge Cederbaum that he be moved.
Finally, the judge took pity on him and allowed him to be transferred to the Metropolitan Correctional Center attached to the courthouse. As he was led out of court, Shug felt the eyes of the white man in the back lingering on him. Looking at Shug, O'Malley thought to himself, "This one's going down hard, and he's going down all the way." Within 2 weeks at MCC, Shug landed in trouble again. Moved to 11 North, Shug and a sex-money murder inmate called Scruff extorted commissary from other inmates with threats of violence. Shug was sent to the hole for a few days. There, he met another old friend. Fresh from testifying in North Carolina, Codd had been placed in the special housing unit for his own protection. Shug had fostered a relationship with a guard who he suspected had blood affiliation. Many guards were adherents of the anti-snitch rhetoric. "Put me up on L-tier," said Shug. "My rat up there." On Shug's way to a shower, the guard unshackled him and let him wander to Codd's cell. On the other side of some thick plexiglass, Codd sat on the bed. "What's good?" said Shug, pressing his face up against the glass. Codd looked at him with a hollow gaze. "Come to the door, man," said Shug from the other side. Codd sensed the threat. "It's over," he said in defeat. "There's only one way out of this." Shug shook his head in disgust. Shug was no rat. He knocked on the glass and then, thwarted, made for the shower. Meanwhile, Shug called his attorney relentlessly. He demanded the lawyer work a plea deal to get him a 15- or 25-year sentence. His lawyer explained the federal system of mandatory minimums and said the prosecutors would not budge. "Look," he said, "you still got multiple charges for murder, conspiracy. If you commit an act of violence in furtherance of an enterprise and you still have all these counts here, you're going to jail for 30 years minimum, probably life. And there's no parole in the federal system." Going through discovery submitted by the government, Shug looked at photographs of the bloodied white football jersey Twin had worn when he murdered him, and he saw the blood-caked pants that indicated Shug had hit an artery in his leg. The same images, and worse, would be presented to the jury. The court appearances came and went. In what had now become routine, Shug was led through multiple doors in the MCC to the basement, where he was passed from prison staff to federal marshals. They hopped, clanked, and stutter-stepped through a long tunnel some 40 feet below Pearl Street, under the footsteps of commuters on their way to work on Wall Street. Officers in distant surveillance stations watched through cameras and opened and closed the doors remotely. At the end of the corridor was an elevator that took them to the courthouse cells. But while Shug was steadfast in his support of Pete, the godfather of sex money murder was cutting a lonelier figure at each court appearance. The jury box began to empty around him. An absent seat meant an erstwhile stalwart had decided to cooperate. One day it was T.P. A few weeks later in the bullpen just before court, George Wallace confided in his nephew that he was terrified and couldn't do any jail time. "Hey, Petey," he whispered, looking around at Mac 11 and the others, "I don't know these kids. You gotta get me up out of this, man. I got nothing to do with this stuff with you and these guys." Rolock stared at him blankly. "I told you to kill Codd," persisted Wallace. "If you'd have done what I said, we wouldn't be here." He paused. "I will make sure your son is a millionaire, and I'll take care of your lawyers. Just keep me off this." Pete looked his uncle up and down. "I ain't going to do the government's job for them." The next court appearance saw another empty seat in the jury box. Wallace was cooperating. Shug began to see the silver-haired detective O'Malley as a specter who snatched his brothers away. Shug and Roe ran their tier like OGs. They controlled the phones, stole gold chains from other inmates, and responded to any challenge with violence, Shug slashing one inmate with a shard from a razor blade. They were mentored by the 6'7" gangster Clarence the Preacher Heatley, also under federal indictment with his preacher crew. "You two are real gangsters," he said. "I like that." Both the young men were familiar with the legend of the preacher on the streets of the Bronx. So-called because of his oratorical powers, the preacher was known in the Harlem and Bronx communities he controlled as the Black Hand of Death, after at least 13 murders, largely drug dealers who defaulted on rent he demanded to sell in his territory. Once, he took two drug dealers to the basement of an apartment building at 2075 Grand Concourse, the crew's headquarters, held a mock trial, and had them both strangled to death. The killings were carried out and supervised by a housing cop, John Cuff, who helped to dismember the victims with a circular saw. Preacher told Shug the story of how in April 1993 he kidnapped the singer Bobby Brown, husband to Whitney Houston. As Houston's star was rising, Brown had sunk into cocaine addiction and owed $25,000 to a dealer in New Jersey. Preacher bought the debt and had his men feed Brown top-quality cocaine in a New York nightclub before luring him to a Bronx apartment. There he was knocked out and awoke, naked and hog-tied. The preacher beat him until he called his famous wife, demanding that she bring $400,000 in cash to settle the debt. According to the newspapers, disguised in a wig and dark glasses, she brought the money the next day. As the Violent Crimes Unit continued to lacerate gangs in New York City and more members found themselves in the MCC, former foes united over one common enemy, cooperators. The Latin Kings approached Rolock and offered a trade-off. They'd attack and try to kill Sex Money Murder's rats, and SMM would do the same for them. Some Latin Kings were on to Green Eyes as a snitch. Pete surprised his acolytes with his stance. "We stand on our own, man. We grew up from the sandbox together," he stated. "Ain't nobody touch no Sex Money Murder rats." Shug and Roe heard that the Kings were going to get Green Eyes sometime during recreation in the open-air steel cage-enclosed basketball court on top of the MCC. In preparation, Shug, Roe, and Preacher went to the roof with hidden razors to protect him. All prisoners were handcuffed as a matter of course. As they reached the deck, they had to put their hands through a slot where a guard uncuffed them. The Kings had fallen in with a Hispanic guard, sympathetic to the gang, who may have been in on the plot. He began to uncuff them first, giving them the advantage. Preacher saw what was about to go down and jumped in front of the still handcuffed Shug and Roe. He faced down the Kings, who were now walking over ready to fight. "Any one of you come in front of me and I'll kick your fucking head off," Preacher said. Uncuffed, they attempted to throw punches. Roe tried to razor one of them before the guards rushed in. Preacher stood on the sideline, holding back any Kings who wanted to exploit the situation. "I dare any of y'all motherfuckers to move," he warned. Afterward, Sex Money Murder got a reputation in the prison for loyalty. "Sex Money banging for their rats," went the cry on the cell blocks. Cod demanded help after hearing Bloods next to his cell in the hole speaking in code. "Shit, they scheming on me, man," he complained to Roe. When Roe asked Shug what he should do, Shug told him, "Give him the code so he can be on point," he said. "He from the hood. He one of ours." Following the assault on the Kings, Shug spent 23 hours a day in lockdown in March 1999. One evening, a ghostly, disembodied voice echoed around the cell. Maybe he was hearing things? It seemed to float up from the toilet in the corner of his cell. He knelt down to get closer. The voice belonged to Green Eyes, now cooperating with the feds. A quirk of the plumbing offered a toilet-style phone system between inmates on different floors. Shug was overjoyed to speak to his friend. The two spoke long into the night. Shug confided in Green Eyes. "I want to go home, Mo," he said. "I'm done with this shit." "You can go home," said the voice out of the toilet bowl. "Bring Baby in. Give them that." Shug refused. He loved Baby like a brother. Green Eyes persisted. "Ain't no one gonna take care of your kids like you." Shug slumped. He had a 5-year-old son in Springfield. "You know Twin wasn't telling," whispered Green Eyes. Shug sat upright. He knew from talking to Pete that it had been a bad call and Twin likely wasn't a snitch. Shug bade him good night and retreated to his bunk, where he brooded all night.
Shug had been willing to give 30 years or more for Pete. But everything was disintegrating. Even Roe had disappeared a month earlier, presumably becoming a cooperator. Shug thought back to a day on the roof when they'd made a pact to help each other, depending on who got down to cooperate first. Even the preacher had suggested Shug turn. "You and Roe like my sons," he said one day. "Fuck Pete. Get yourself up out of this shit. The Titanic's going down. Grab a life jacket. They stopped me at third base, but you can do it." The preacher had tried to cooperate with Liz Glazer, but they'd shut him down. Too many murders, and besides, they knew he had fathered a child by his own daughter. They could never put him in front of a jury. The next morning, Shug called up to Green Eyes. "You think they'll talk to me?" Green Eyes said there was an older white guy everyone trusted. "Ask to talk to O'Malley," he said. "He'll look out for you." O'Malley didn't believe at first that the Thanksgiving Day shooter, the lunatic who had been shouting and screaming in court, wanted to come and talk. Some of the higher-ups in the office were reluctant on moral grounds to sign up killers as cooperators. Also, prosecutors sometimes had a tendency to overbuy the number of cooperators, including those with serious charges, in order to get the inside track on a conspiracy and to make the case impregnable. Roloff's lawyers thought that he had a winnable case. He wasn't at the scene of the shootings on Thanksgiving. To get the actual shooter would be beneficial to Nicole LaBarbera, who had taken over as prosecutor from Alexandra Shapiro. And there'd been some problems with the current witnesses. Codd had written to a friend outside the MCC that when he got out, he was going to do it right next time and not get caught. The letter had been intercepted. Roloff's defense lawyers would use his boasts as a way to damage his credibility on the stand. A former English major at Princeton, the 31-year-old LaBarbera, whose good looks often made gangsters shy, came from a sheltered childhood in suburban Long Island. LaBarbera earned her law degree at Fordham Law School and then later signed on as a clerk to Judge John F. Keenan in the Southern District of New York. Long after everyone had left the office, she pored over Keenan's trial transcripts and crime scene photographs. The trial narratives reminded her of the Sam Shepard plays she'd loved as an undergraduate. She saw the work of a federal prosecutor as honorable, representing and pursuing the truth while protecting the public. Defense lawyers, she felt, sometimes didn't have the same obligation to the truth and merely advanced the causes of their clients. She immediately felt at home in Liz Glazer's violent gangs unit, which offered a uniquely investigative and aggressive crime-fighting mandate. She found common cause with O'Malley, and she saw that when he worked with cooperators, he expressed exactly what he was thinking. It wasn't a game to him, and he didn't fool people into trusting him. The experience of her first trial against a Harlem drug dealer had been unnerving, despite securing a conviction. Over time, LaBarbera discovered she much preferred the behind-the-scenes investigative work, solving cases with detectives and investigators and building a rapport with cooperators, to the grand theater of court that other more extroverted prosecutors thrived on. But nothing could prepare her for the challenge of sex money murder, a vast and sprawling multi-defendant case. On her first day in court, she faced a jury box full of gangsters who shot her poisonous looks. LaBarbera had been driven into Soundview in a blacked-out federal cruiser, and even before they hit the block, the crews knew they were coming. LaBarbera felt someone might try to shoot them. She was struck by how many feral dogs roamed the neighborhood. Soundview could have been a sanctuary on the banks of the river, she felt, were it not a failed social experiment. LaBarbera saw a role for herself in fighting for a community oppressed by fear. Shug seemed to be one of the gang's worst, veering near her table menacingly when he came into court. She wondered how a jury would react if a killer like Shug were given a break in return for his testimony for the government. She had serious misgivings about using him and was doubtful he would even be honest. After all, Roloff had never been offered the chance to cooperate, because he'd have to plead to all his murders and then give up someone bigger than himself. The feds don't sign up the whale to get the minnows. They decided to move ahead with the meeting with Shug, but O'Malley took no chances.
He insisted upon extra marshals and Forselli as a backup in the proffer room. They called Shug's lawyer to set it up. Shug's lawyer was as baffled as anyone else that his client would consider cooperating. Shug said that he was just mulling it, nothing definite. Some lawyers were anti-rat, too, and disliked cooperators because it cut into the fees they could earn from a trial. Others didn't think anyone should cooperate as a matter of principle and hated opening up their cooperating clients to the prosecution's questions. "You're my mouthpiece, right?" Shug said to his lawyer. "Then get down there and let me see what they have to say." That night, Shug settled uneasily into the bottom bunk, alone in his cell, weighing his decision. A bridge ran from the MCC to the old courthouse and then to the U.S. Attorney's office. Shug was moved across it to a small holding cell. He was left to wait and wonder whether he was making a mistake, whether he could handle becoming the kind of rat he had always hated. He had come to doubt the loyalty that had drawn him into sex money murder, the faith that his brothers would always protect each other. But his faith in the family was still hard to surrender entirely. A tall, imposing man in an open-necked shirt whom he knew as O'Malley appeared at the door with a burly, swaggering cop. The prison handcuffs were removed, and the white-haired man fastened his own set of cuffs around Shug's wrists. They let him out. The man towered over him, gripping his biceps with a strong hand. They began to walk over from the old courthouse to the U.S. Attorney's office, a metaphorical passage to the world of the cooperating witness. Sunlight fell through big, dusty windows on his right, warming Shug's face as they walked. By just crossing the bridge, he was closer to the outside world again. All he had to do on the other side was talk. But every footstep was one step closer to upending his universe. The room where they took their seats was hot and airless, choked with mismatched chairs, some high-backed leather, some wooden, laid out around three tables. On the far wall, someone had set up a whiteboard. Shug sat next to Martin Siegel, his lawyer. He found himself blushing at La Barbera's beauty in spite of his urge to frown at the seriousness of the situation. Reflexively, he thought he'd have an easier time with her, that she'd be more lenient than a man and he could charm and manipulate her. Forselli sat next to La Barbera. O'Malley took a seat at Shug's right elbow and stared at him. O'Malley told Shug that this would be the most important 10 minutes of his life. He didn't want him to say a word, just to listen. "I never thought you'd come down here," he said. "I never liked you, and I didn't like what you did in court." Shug hadn't expected this to start on such a negative note. He had thought they'd want to hear what he had to say. O'Malley chewed on the earpiece of his glasses, contemplating Shug with indifference. "We're not promising you anything," O'Malley said. "A lot of your guys are going away for a long time. Some won't be able to do that time. Those who can't want to sit in that chair you are sitting in right now. You are already in that chair, so you're ahead of the game. Once you leave that chair, you can't get back in again because you've been replaced. In the past, guys like you have gone away and watched their buddies testify, and they say, 'I should have listened to that old guy.'" La Barbera followed O'Malley's lead. "I know this isn't your thing, Shug," she said. "We'll be honest with you, but you have to be honest with us." Shug leered at her as she talked. O'Malley told him that he would have to describe every crime, from stealing out of his grandmother's purse to what happened on Thanksgiving. "I want the whole loaf," he declared, "not just slices." Shug nodded. 90% of everything we already know," said La Barbera. "What you think we don't know even now, we know. We don't need you to make this case." Shug was unsettled now. He thought he'd be here laying down his conditions, and yet it was the other way around. He grew enraged, not knowing whether he could trust them. O'Malley asked him a few questions to test him, and Shug offered what he thought was his trump card. "I killed Twin." The words hovered over the table. "We know that already," La Barbera said. Shug struggled to give them something. "Pete ordered it." La Barbera said, We know that, too. They knew everything. This was a sealed deal. There was no way he would have won in court. Anxiety washed over him. The guys who had gotten to O'Malley and La Barbera before him had given it all up. He had nothing to offer. O'Malley asked about the guns used on Thanksgiving Day and where they were. Shug didn't know. He felt humiliated.